Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast with my dad, Ted Knightsey.
Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. I'm your host, Ted Knightsey. Well, this is a little bit of a longer conversation, but I think it's very timely as so many teachers across the United States and the world are trying to prepare themselves for an unknown fall or end of the school year, depending where you are. So what I wanted to do here was talk to an expert on how to design instructional practices or how to create opportunities for adult learning and maximize science so that we can do our very best. A lot of school districts across the world are going into a blended version of the start of the school year where they're going to have some classes online and some classes in person. Some people are doing an only in person and some people are doing a full online version. What I wanted to do was talk to someone who could give us advice on how to optimize our ability to get the most out of whatever instructional practice we put forward to help kids or adults. I talked to Jared Horvath, who is a professor in Australia at the University of Melbourne, and he is a neuroscientist and an expert on engaging the brain. He's going to tell us some things in this interview that, frankly, are going to blow your mind. Pun intended. Take a listen. Have a pen handy. Be in a place where you can listen to this for 15 minutes, stop and reflect. Stop and reflect and listen. Listen and stop and reflect. Because he's going to share with you a lot of little secrets on how to design incredibly strong instructional practices. And here's the first thing I'm going to tell you that blew my mind. The human brain only has the energy every day to learn for 3 hours. That's it. 3 hours. All right. Take a listen. Enjoy. And we'll see you at the end with a couple of reflective questions. And she said, do you come from a land down under?
All right, so Jared, welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. I'm today being joined by Jared Horvath, who's coming to me from West Australia, correct? Or East Australia?
Oh, no, I'm down in, I am in Melbourne. I'm locked and loaded, so it's Southeast Australia.
It is tomorrow in our conversation for me with him, because here it is 5 o'clock at night and there it is 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, sir.
So I always think that for me, that's just as a history geography teacher, that's always a big nerd point for me. I think it's amazing that you know what's going to happen a day before I do. So
anyways, you're living in the past. You get to enjoy the past yet again.
Right. No one thinks it's funny when I think that you can predict the scores of games that are being played tonight because you'll have tomorrow's paper, but.
Anyway. I wish that worked. That would have been awesome.
It'd be cool for betting purposes, but that's about it. So anyways, Jared, tell us a little bit about yourself. So like, you know, what do you do down in Melbourne? You know, you're American, you're from the United States, but you're down in Melbourne. How'd you get there? What do you do? And, you know, how come you know so much about the brain?
So I'm from the States originally. And then I was a teacher originally back in when I lived in the West Coast, so LA, Seattle. But back when I was teaching, the neuroscience, the brain stuff started to become really popular, the decade of the brain. So I figured, all right, if I go back and learn about neuroscience, that'll make me a better teacher. So what was meant to be like a 2-year jaunt becomes, I think I'm at 15 years now, stuck in academia, looking at neuroscience, psychology, behavioral economics, essentially everything that has to do with learning at some level I've now played with. And I've done all of that for the express purpose of going back to teachers and students and saying, here's the useful bits, right? If this is how we learn, here's the good stuff, here's the nonsense, here's the stuff we can use, here's the kind of trash. So that's kind of what I've been doing now. So I met, my wife is from Melbourne, so I met her about 10 years ago, moved out here. And now I spend my time, between university and schools, either doing research or working with students and teachers saying, all right, here's science of learning. Now, how do we adapt that to make teaching or study better for everyone? Because I'd love it if it was a one-to-one, like because we learn like this, everyone teach like this. But context is so important in the classroom that we'll never have that one-to-one shot. So the best we can do is say, if this is how we learn, how do we now adapt that for your context? So there's a lot of one-on-one work, which becomes super important. But I kind of love it. I kind of live in that gray zone between the laboratory and the classroom, I say.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And so, like, what are you researching now? What's a current project that you are you got a whole bunch of grad students out there collecting info for you on? Or
thank goodness, actually, ever since Corona, everything's kind of shut down. So I haven't done anything really in the last about 4 or 5 months. But I've, since schools are starting to kind of trickle back in, I'm working now because I think a lot of the good digital questions kind of popped up during COVID. So one of the things I'm really interested in is that level of the screen. As soon as you put a screen, so we know once you put a screen up, learning just starts to go down. It's one of the weirdest things. Like, you give me a group of kids and I teach to them and they can't say anything. They can't ask questions. They just have to listen. Now film that and put another group of kids in a room right next door. They watch the exact same thing on a screen and there will be a difference in the learning where the live kids learn a little bit more than the kids who saw it on a screen. No difference, nothing else, even the same exact moment it's happening. It's just the screen does something. So I want to kind of start playing with that with young kids to see, okay, is it an emotional thing? Is it a psychological thing? What is it about just inserting a screen that seems to derail learning slightly? Like, it's not massive things. Like, it's not like they don't learn anything, but there is a shift. So I want to try and start digging into that to figure out, okay, what's really going on? If there is even something to figure out, who knows?
Well, I mean, just anecdotally, I would think that my whole life, screens represent entertainment, not learning.
Yeah. So, well, you've got the big, I think that's the, if you look at the numbers, it's pretty interesting. So per year, and we're talking about teenagers at this point, a kid will use a computer about 2,200 hours a year. That's on average, which means some kids are way beyond. So yeah. Put that into context, if you slept 6 hours a night every night this year, that's about 2,100 hours. So you'll be on your computer more than you'll be sleeping this year. Now, of that time, 2,000 of those hours, so over 90%, is doing exactly what you said, playing games, watching movies, surfing the web, doing my Twitter. About 190 of those hours are spent learning. So we've got this massive discrepancy already where as soon as you sit a kid down in front of a computer, they've got 2,000 hours a year of experience saying, oh, this machine is used for fun, for enjoyment, for flitting around. And we say, now we're trying to say, oh no, now you have to use it for learning. And that's a huge obstacle to overcome. It's not that they can't learn on it. It's that they're so well trained at not learning on it that once we say you have to, they have to fight this counter story where it's like, but that's not what I do here. I always kind of say, it's like if you gave me a group of alcoholics around a table and I put a jug of beer in the middle and I said, all right, I want you to use that beer to learn about buoyancy. There's nothing about the beer that says you can't use it to learn about buoyancy. It's just everyone around that story has a really deep story about what beer is supposed to be used for already.
Sure.
And I'm guessing that after about 10 hours of work, they're not going to learn about buoyancy. They might learn about self-control, but they're not focused on the learning. They're focused on, well, that's not what this tool is supposed to be for. Yeah. So you just already have this kind of obstacle thing. But if you can control all of that, like you would assume, if I could just film myself, shut down your computer, and all you can do is watch my face teaching you. If I can control all external variables, why do you still go down a little bit? And the only thing I can start to think is there isn't, it's that emotional component that every teacher knows about, but that science is just really slow to catch up with, to recognize that, yeah, there is communication that happens between people live that isn't verbal, that isn't gestural, that's somehow an exchange of information just by being next to each other. That seems to be meaningful when it comes to teaching and learning. And I think that's, every teacher in the world will say, yeah. But science, we still haven't quite figured out what it is yet. So we're still saying, who knows what that could be?
Well, and do you think, so, I mean, just the way the brain and the heart are connected, you know, the individual nuances of when I'm in a classroom with students and I walk past a kid and I just give an endearing look, that reinforces behavior, reinforces, you know, risk, whatever.
Yeah.
I would guess that that would increase engagement and learning looking at 25 1-inch by 1-inch little people where I'm trying to figure out, you know, who's reading a push alert right now from TMZ, you know, instead of focusing on the learning, because that even as adults sitting on the computer all day long is really, really difficult.
Yeah.
So, well, so with that,
like you were saying, you've got the vision and the gestural, but I also think there's something about physical, like even if your eyes were closed and you couldn't see me, if I'm standing next to you and anyone who's married knows this, if you're in the same room and your wife or your husband comes in and they're in a bad mood, you know it immediately. You don't have to see it. You don't have to, you feel it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or if they're in a great mood, you feel this shift. So there's even beyond, if you couldn't even see me, there's something I can pass on sensations to you just by being near you. And that's something that even if it's just one-on-one online, you still miss that exchange. But what that is, I don't know if it's magnetic waves. Is it? I don't know what the heck it is.
I don't know
what something there.
I don't know what it is either. But after almost 30 years with my wife, between being boyfriend, girlfriend, and husband and wife, when I enter the city limits, I can feel it when I'm in trouble. So I don't need to be in the same room anymore.
We know what's going on. It's one of those mornings. All right.
Sometimes I just drive right through town. I just keep going. So, well, with that, let's just get a little background and context. So you're at the university. You want to tell us a little bit about what you do there?
And then, I'm at University of Melbourne. And for a while, well, I have been for about the last, 6 years now, I've been lecturer and researcher. But again, who knows what the heck's going to happen? About 60% of us are on leave right now because of Corona, and we don't know how many of us are going to get back into it, just because universities got hit so hard. Their entire model was based on international tuition. There is no international tuition anymore. So we're just kind of, if you had asked me about a year ago, I'd say I'm a lecturer and a researcher. Ask me now, I say, I got a desk there. But I'm not sure what I'm going to do at it yet.
Yeah. Well, entrepreneurial opportunity.
There's always change.
How's that hack colleague of yours, Hattie, doing? John Hattie, right?
He's hanging in there. He's doing all right. He as always, he and I kind of butt heads. So lovely. I always like to point out, he was the one who always taught me, attack the idea, never attack the person. Lovely human being. Him and I get along. Just wonderful dude. Our ideas seem to clash quite frequently. So he's still doing what he does. And I still just kind of giggle on the sideline, I guess.
Right. Well, and that's, but you know, there's a lot of people who buy into and live their lives by effect size strategies, which is kind of like the perfect segue for kind of my questions for you today, which is, so my first one is, what are the developmental considerations teachers need to make when they are designing digital and online instruction for their students? So backing up a second, Jared, tell us about the book you wrote, because that's a phenomenal text, and that will lead into this next question.
Yeah. So there was last year we came out with a book called Stop Talking, Start Influencing, 12 Insights from Brain Science to Make Your Message Stick. So the idea was essentially each chapter is a different, what I'd call learning principle, a nugget. So it's something we know that works acontextually. The brain does it, the body does it, students do it. And so once you know these kind of nuggets and why they work, then you can start to adapt them and apply them wherever. So you can assume like one of them has to do with multitasking. We were talking about what you do online. Boom. No human being can multitask. It's probably the single worst thing you could do for learning. That's going to be the same online, offline, upstairs, downstairs, outside, inside. So once you've got that nugget and some ideas, now you can start to implant that in whatever it is you're doing. So that whole book is just based on, can we do 12 learning principles and see how they then apply to the classroom? But what's interesting is with this COVID stuff, now we get to see, they all still apply. How do we adapt them then for the digital, for this distance learning or blended learning, whichever one people are doing?
Yeah. And your book, we featured it on the podcast a couple months ago. And, a lot of people have read it. Some people have done some book studies back with their teaching staff and taken the 12 principles and adopted, one per month. Go out and let's alpha test this in the class. Let's see how this goes. Changing their slides. Like personally, after I read it, I went through sinfully every slide deck I had for all my different presentations. And it was like 5 words, big font, little picture, that's it. And then just keep people engaged, because otherwise, as you've said, it's really distracting.
So it feels dull when you're making it. You're like, oh, this is too simple. But now when you're there teaching with it, you see, okay, the connection is now a lot stronger.
Yeah. Well, and now you can create one big thing I took from that is, when I'm speaking, per se, when I'm doing a keynote, I will have a gigantic image behind me reinforcing my message, opposed to 62 bullet points where everybody in the audience thinks they need to capture all of that. Now they can engage in the story and they see the visual of, what a gap diagram looks like or whatever it is.
So, I love that. That's whenever it hasn't happened in a while, but when you're at those conferences, whenever somebody puts up a slide and you see all the phones go up in the audience to take a picture of it, That's how you know you've probably put too much information on your slide. If people need right. to take a picture of it to remember it later, you've probably overdone it there a bit.
Right. Well, that's also when my vanity comes out, because then I usually kind of pose and flex up.
But. Oh, we're taking the photos.
Nice. Yeah, yeah. You want me to autograph that later? So anyway, so tell me a little bit about, you know, so right now in the United States, coronavirus, eighth wave, whatever we're in, nobody knows anymore. We're all tired of talking about it, but we are getting ready to start the school year. And many schools are starting asking teachers to be prepared with a blended approach. Now, last year when we went in a shutdown, we were in reaction mode, really, really hard work done by teachers.
Yeah.
Now, I think the professional development opportunity is, okay, as we are designing instructional components for the kids, what are some developmental considerations we need to make, you know, that you know of based on your research? Like, what are one or two nuggets that we need to consider when we design instruction?
So this will be, so for thinking purely, say, developmental, we then have to break, we'll break it down into kind of our two sections. We'll say the younger kids, so kind of elementary school, and then we'll say the older kids, middle high school. The kind of big accusation point you see developmentally in those two ages concerns thought patterns. During the younger ages, the brain and the system works primarily on input. It's in, this is how the brain learns the world. This is how students learn the world. It's give me, give me, give me, and I'm going to sort it all out kind of up here. Whereas as you get older, once you hit middle school, high school, the brain flips into a new mode where it's largely self-driven, where now it's okay, I've got enough input. My brain's kind of organized itself. Now I've got to learn how to run this machine. And we kind of call this top-down processing. And that's why one of the reasons why teenagers are so weird is as adults, we can now sit in the middle. We can get input or we can push back ourselves. Kids are largely only input. Teenagers are learning how to push back themselves. And that just leads to a lot of really weird, trippy things. We'll talk about that some other time. But so this kind of means developmentally from say K through five, there's got to be a lot of a lot of interaction as much as is humanly possible. There's got to be a lot of give, do, here's more, here's let's have fun. It's not, and I don't mean lecturing, but I mean, this is why I like games and stuff. It's input. I'm doing something. I'm exploring something. I'm smelling something. I'm touching something. I'm tasting something. That can then switch high school, middle school. You can start to move into back into the more didactic model, the more lecturing type model, because they're going to be doing a lot more work up here than they need to be doing out here. So this just starts to say, okay, how then do you, in K through five, how do you make it as interactive as is humanly possible? And it kind of sucks. There's some great programs for it, but there's also this issue of how do you then get them offline? Most good interaction is going to take place offline. So are there things they could be printing out and playing with, or things they could be doing with their parents if they're stuck at home? Otherwise, they're stuck online. And online is good for it. It gives you some stuff, but I don't know that it gives you all the stuff you need. You miss some of that connection that we were talking about earlier. Whereas once you get into then the higher levels, yep, you can do a lot less of the do. You can do a lot more of the teach and think, discuss. Teach, discuss. They can handle that better online. So you kind of have that point. Are you elementary school or are you kind of middle high school? And that's what we're thinking. Oh, you got your water. Good to go.
Yes, I had to get a beverage here. Thank you.
Nice. So it's a lot more doing versus a lot more thinking from the younger versus the older kids. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. So like, you know, you mentioned games.
Yeah.
You know, interactive play. What do you think are just one example of an engaging, I don't want to use the word an engaging tactic or strategy that couldn't be employed by take a 10th grade, you know, sophomore year English teacher.
Yep.
What do they need to consider developmentally? Because, you know, for them to just go online and say, okay, turn to page 12 and I'm going to read to you this play.
Boom. So here's where you get your tactics. This is where that blended model comes good. So let's say we go year 10. What you do is online digital now, let's go for our hook. So, okay, what I'm going to do is before we teach and learn, I'm going to give you a story. And that story is going to end at a very hard point, which is the cliffhanger. So something is going to be happening, and then boom, you don't know what's going to happen next. Now, if you want to find out the answer of what happened next, you have to teach me. So now we move into the didactic portion. So that's where they can then split into the groups, do their readings offline, go online, do their research, come back, figure it out. And then you have to bring back your solution to me. How did this story end? And ideally that hook is a true story. So it's really, in medicine, we do it kind of, well, we should do it more, but it's much easier because that's kind of the way I think, where I can lead you down a set of symptoms, bring a patient into a room where we see him and now the eyes are yellow and he's coughing and all this is about to happen. And now you have to go do a diagnosis. I'm not even going to tell you what we found. And so the hook, we use the online to get them thinking, to get them tied into the learning. And then you decide, okay, what's the best way to actually get that learning? It could be that you then teach them here. It could be that they then have their textbook offline. Now go do your learning over here, whatever it's going to be. But it's that hook kind of brings them in and then draws them through that 30, 50 minute session, whatever it's going to be. I think a good point, I just want to kind of circle back, is with digital, going back to now the younger kids, a lot of digital programs that are being made, they're highly engaging, right? I mean, this is, kids love the cell phones, the laptops, apps. They have a good old time on those. The problem is, and it's not really a problem, but it's just something to consider, is engagement is not synonymous with learning. You could be as engaged as the happiest kid in the world and not learn a thing. And you can be mildly engaged with something and learn a ton. So it turns out engagement, and we did just think about movies. I always kind of talk about, like, I've seen every Marvel movie and for the 2 hours I'm watching it, man, I'm engaged. I love it. 2 days later, I couldn't tell you anything about it. Whereas I watch something like Affliction, which it's a really uncomfortable film and I'm not wildly engaged. I don't even really like it all that much. But because I go through proper learning where I talk about it with my wife, we debate the merits of it. What was the themes? When you go through the learning process, boom, you remember so much more about it. So the problem with a lot of new programs coming out during COVID are they're wildly engaging, but they're engaging on the wrong thing. So they're fun. They're like Oregon Trail. You'll play it for hours and hours and hours, but you'll learn nothing about the Oregon Trail. You'll learn how to hunt, game, and ford a river and die of dysentery. That's all you'll learn. So a good kind of rule of thumb is we form memories for those things we think about. So when it comes to engagement online, whatever tool you're using, if it's a game, if it's a lesson, make sure the engaging aspect is the thing you want them learning about. The thing that has to draw them in has to be relevant to the message you want them to be leaving with. It can't be tangential to it. So a simple example that Dan William always talks about is a school, they were doing a project on war efforts for people who weren't soldiers. And they said, okay, you know, we can demonstrate this by having kids bake Anzac cookies. So during the war here in Australia, that's what they did. All the homebodies baked cookies, sold them, and that money went off to the war effort to support the soldiers. Cool. So the kids baked these Anzac cookies. They come back later and quiz them on war efforts, and no kid has any clue what they're talking about. Why? Because you only learn what you pay attention to. They were attending to baking cookies. So they learned how to make a cookie, but they didn't learn anything about Anzac war efforts or giving back. So it's, you got to make sure whatever it is that's engaging them isn't tangential or just fun. Oh, it's a gold star, it's cool. That thing has to be the learning. I call it the Duolingo effect. By on average, and I'm going to butcher the numbers, I haven't looked at the research in a while, but on average, I think human beings, like if you ever learn a second language online, people who use Duolingo do about 20 minutes more per day. So we're looking at a couple hours more per week of language learning on that app versus any other language learning app. When you look at the learning, no one learns any better on that app. So the learning on Duolingo versus everything else is exactly the same. So essentially that's two completely wasted hours of your life you didn't need to spend. So why do people spend so much time on there? It's because they're getting points, they're getting stars, they're focused on all this frill that keeps them going,
right?
Which is cool, that gives you more time, more engaging, but it's focused on the wrong thing, so the learning ain't there. So what is it, especially for the K-5 kids, if you're going to be doing activities, make sure the activity is gearing them to think about the right stuff.
So let me reiterate two things, or just kind of review them for that. One is electronic motivations for points, avatar stuff. That's engagement. That's not going to be learning.
Big
right, deal. That's how I'm hearing that. So,
yep.
You know, like, oh, you get extra credit if we see that you've been online for 90 minutes opposed to 60. Fine, I'll sit here for another half hour, yep. Kind of stuff. The second thing that you said, though, that I wrote down right away, we form memories from things we think about. So I just want to break this down for review of how you said that, because this is how I heard it. As so like tomorrow, if I'm going online to teach social studies, what I need to do is I need to introduce a rich, engaging story. I need to get the hook, right? My anticipatory set, like, hey, this is what we're going to learn about. Here's why it's important. Introduce the skill, but then click off, go apply, collaborate, utilize, use, and then come back and demonstrate.
Yep.
Is that okay?
That sounds bingo. The weird thing about, well, no, not the weird thing. The good thing about online learning is whatever works in the classroom will work online. We just have to dance around it. But if it's a good method live, you can assume it's going to be a good method online. So that's exactly what we do in a classroom is hook them, let them learn, work, practice, come back, show me, let's debrief.
Boom. But I think one of the things that we're missing, or the gap, as, from my experience as a father with two kids who did digital right away, is that that aspect of apply, collaborate, and utilize was missed. It was a lot of compliance. So it reminded me of digital worksheets. Like if you finish this, you get a B. If you do this and this, you put, you know, sparkle dust on it, or glitter. I cannot believe it.
Sparkle dust. No, I'm going with sparkle dust.
We'll go with sparkle dust. Anyways, my point is that true learning is not going to happen in compliance mode and motivation mode, where it's engaging and fun. True learning is going to happen in base, strong teaching methods, and then learning to utilize those methods in application outside of the general classroom.
Yep. And so that's it. And what's interesting too, is if you bring up the word compliance. So a lot of, like you just said, a lot of the digital stuff has become compliance based, reward based. Hey, here's some stars, here's some points, have a good time. The trippy thing about that is compliance doesn't lead to any better learning. In fact, there's evidence that compliance learning leads to very narrow learning. You get to, when you're there, you do it. When you're gone, you don't. But the trippy thing is with compliance-based learning, as soon as you remove the reward, all the behaviors that you built through compliance mode go away as well. So if I get a class that's really good because I'm giving them pizza parties every Friday, boom, everyone will say, man, your kids are so well-behaved. Yep. As soon as they take away the pizza halfway through the year to be like, okay, we don't need reward, we're all good. Watches all the kids go back to doing what they were always doing. They weren't learning the actual behavior. They weren't learning the actual material. They were simply learning the given attack. And if I sit, I get a piece of pizza. If I sit. So the whole, here's a treat, here's a sparkles, here's some sparkle dust, that stuff. It's good to get behavioral compliance, but that ain't going to change a thing in the long run. So we got to be going a little deeper than that.
But I think that's an important piece, because a lot of my friends, and I'm sure a lot of the people listening, struggle with how to develop really strong practices online, because they don't view this the same way I view my classroom. You know, when I plan my classroom lesson, I'm thinking of the children in those seats, the relationships I have with them. I anticipate what's going to work and what's not going to work. And this digital platform, it's like constantly shooting at an unknown target.
Yeah.
And you don't find success when you do that. So to hear, Jared, that just basically that four-step piece, right? Introduce the concept, the story, get the hook. Second, you know, introduce the skill. Third, go off and apply it. Work collaboratively with others, because again, we form memories from things we think about. Go think about it and then come back and demonstrate your knowledge. And that's not in necessarily a Google form, 5 true false question format. That's actual engaging the brain.
Well, I think what's interesting is we've used this tool so weird in the past, because we've only used it tangentially. It's only the only reason we'd use a computer in a classroom most of the time is because, it's time for a quiz. It's easier to do it online, have a good time. The issue is now we've just got to think past that. Because we've used it that way for 10 years in the classroom, doesn't mean that's the only way to use it. And now we got to come back and just go, no, you know what? I still got quizzes online. That's fine. But exactly what I did live, I'm going to do here. I just might have to think differently, where, okay, I need every kid to sign off and call your friend on WhatsApp. or I need everyone to go into a breakout room. I know Zoom has breakout rooms where I'm going to shoot you off and you're going to have three people in a room for the next 20 minutes to work on this. The only thing we might have to do online is, so you have to just think, how would I do it? And it can be the same as live, is you just might need a slight more structure. So live, I can watch kids doing everything and I can see who's going off task and, oh, that's going to be a bad move. Let me pull you back. That's a little harder digital if I have to go from room to room to room. So I just add a little bit more structure to the tasks I'm having them go play with. So whereas live, I might just say, hey, go play. Here, I might say, go play. Here are the three big things I want you to start here. Move into this, this. Just add a little more structure to make sure that if I'm not seeing you, you might not go totally off track.
Yeah, so let's do some jazz here. I'm going to riff off of that because one of the things we've started to apply, or I've applied, is when you go into your breakout rooms, and this is with adults in a corporate setting, right? We're going to put you in your breakout rooms. However, breakout room A, I'm coming in there at this time. So all of a sudden now there's like a, well, shoot, we actually got to do this because he's checking, right? Breakout room B, I'm coming at this time. Breakout room C, I'm coming at this time. Breakout room D. Now, once I'm done with all the breakout rooms, I will be stopping in each of your breakout rooms about every 5 to 10 minutes to just be able to progress monitor and ask questions or answer your questions.
Yeah.
Because again, if I'm 12 and you put me in a digital breakout room with five of my friends, I'm going to be like, hey, you want to see my cat? Because my cat's here. And then some other kid's like, oh yeah, look at this, man. I got all my cards here for Pokemon, you know, like, oh, and then somebody will be there going, listen, at 5:27, he said he's coming in the room. Guys, we got to get ready. So that's, I think just for the teachers listening, like, yeah, use those things, but also don't trust that, you know, group of kids, even 19-year-olds or 38 or 50-year-olds, they're not going to stay on task unless there is that level of accountability in that, like, or your word, structure.
It's the same thing too. It's we all know that live too, man. When I break out in my rooms live and I'm going working with one group of kids, I know group kid B in the corner they're talking about sports. So it happens live too. So a lot of people like to blame, and I don't, get me wrong, I'm probably as close to a Luddite as you'll possibly get. I hate technology. I hate computers, but I don't blame computers. Kids will do that everywhere. That's their entire job, is to try and push back. So I'm not shocked, and I don't think, oh, computers suck when a kid does it. I just go, yep, that's what kids do. Let's keep them on task.
But I think it's the mental, framework of, just like in my classroom, you know, a high performing teacher is moving, giving feedback. Yep. There you go. Let's try this. Have you thought of it this way? Tell me what you're doing here. We've got to do that digital movement now within those breakout rooms and make sure, because again, I hate the word accountability, but if they know you're coming and they know the task and they know how to apply it and they know that you're going to be there to support them, well, that's a different digital relationship.
Boom. And it doesn't, and like you just said, doesn't have to be different from the same things that work in a classroom will work online. We just have to think, okay, what's the right way to get around it? And if a breakout room is the right way to do it, go to town.
So Jared, let's transition then to my next question. So, So those are some developmental considerations and, frankly, some really good methods. What are some brain things we need to be considering here, right? So your niche is that neurological piece. What are, you know, practical things about sitting here? And I'm just going to give you one anecdotal thing about myself. Through COVID, when this started and they said, we're going to be in lockdown, I drove a truck to a, like, lumber yard. I bought a ton of stuff because I thought, like, oh my Lord, I'm going to have so much time.
Yeah.
All that lumber's in my basement in my wood shop. I built one thing in 5 months because what's ended up happening in the digital universe is I have no transitions. I have no brain breaks. I have no shoot the bull by the water fountain time. What ends up happening is I go from Zoom meeting from 7:30 to 9, 9 to 10, 10 to 11, 11 to 12, 12 to 12:30, I'm off. And then I'm usually on a device, checking email. I'm exhausted at the end of the day, right? So I know for me, neurologically, this, you know, I'm pointing to my brain. We're in a podcast and I'm doing that verbal. Just for everybody listening, Jared and I are seeing each other. But like, what is it for kids? What should a good day look like if I'm digitally active for my brain, and what do I need to make sure that I do in my instruction so that my brain is engaged? Answer all three of those questions.
To answer them now in one sentence, go. Yeah. I think you've nailed it. Is a very interesting topic is that exhaustion, the brain exhaustion. So when you're in learning mode, when you're not doing anything, your brain uses about 25% of all the energy in your body. So when you're just vegging out watching Netflix, a quarter of your energy zips up to your brain. It's just a sink. When you're in actual learning mode, like, okay, taking in new information or dealing with something you don't quite understand yet, your brain needs a ton more energy. And it can't get it from your blood. There's just not enough blood vessels in there. So what it does is it taps into a second energy reserve, which is kind of stored, we think, between neurons in your brain. And that is learning. You can feel it when it happens. That's when you've ever been deeply focused on something. I call it that kind of top-down coder mode. You feel it kick in. That's you tapping into that second source. Now, two issues with that second source are, one, there's a finite amount of it. Most human beings, we refill it when we sleep at night. So depending on how much sleep you got the night before, you've only got about 3 to 4 hours of extra juice. Once you hit the end, you're out. You're done. Your learning is done for the day. So this means we've got probably, I would estimate, like a max of 3 hours of true learning we can do during a day with kids. And we know this live, so it's going to be the same exact thing digital. But importantly, now, as a second bit to that, those 3 hours, if you did it all in one stretch, you get diminishing returns. So we do this weird research where if I have a 30-minute class versus a 60-minute class, kids in the 60-minute class only learn about 8% more than the kids in the 30-minute class. It's because if you're in learning mode for an hour, it just dips so fast that about 30 minutes you hit a decussation point and it just starts to, you get diminishing returns, you get less and less. So this kind of, you start to think about, okay, how do I do, say, a 30-minute chunk with enough of a break to reset that I can come back and buy another 30 minutes? With enough of a break, reset, so I can come back and get another 30 minutes. Now, all up, this might only be half of a day. So if I'm doing small chunks, 30-minute lessons with a nice 5, 10, 15-minute break where the kid can go run around, do his thing, now that still gives me half a day. What do I do with the kids are done if I've tapped them out at this point? Well, luckily, practice doesn't require that extra energy. So now, if you build in huge practice sessions where it's like, now we've done some new learning, cool, but now we're just going to focus on things we've already done before. We're just going to start locking down skills. That won't require this energy. Or if you can get a kid into what's called a flow state, that doesn't require this extra energy. Now, flow state takes a while to get into, but once you're in it, for those of you who don't know what this is, that's if you've ever been in a state where you're so absorbed with a task that you just lose track of time, like you're gardening and all of a sudden it's 10 hours later, you're like, what the heck just happened here? Like, it happens for me when I'm painting. Kids, when they're playing video games, that's when they get into a flow state. My nephew will play for 5 hours straight and not have a clue that he just did it. You can get into a flow state once you get wildly absorbed with anything you're practicing. So it could be that you teach in the morning and then in the afternoon, you have a nice 2-3 hour session where they've got one task that they have to get absorbed in. So it's a big project or something that they're working on. It's like, now you've got 3 hours to really work on that video project or this. And the idea being that that might give them enough time. They don't need that extra energy. If they work on it long enough, they're going to get into that flow state and it'll just cruise through. And now you've got like half a day of learning, half a day of practice flow state production, and that might be it. And then off you go, go play your video games, have a good time tonight. There's no homework needed because you did your work today. So that's kind of what I'm thinking. So online, if you hit these 30-minute kind of chunks, so you've only got about 3 hours, 4 hours before anyone's going to tap out. Do you ever recognize that? Have you been to like a 2-day conference?
Oh, dude, like right now I am thinking of all the ways I have sinned.
That
as an educator, as a professional development person, you know, because what you said, you know, and I'm sure everybody listening is like, oh my Lord. We have 7.5 hours of school. Within that 7.5 hours, there are 5 minutes of passing period, 6 times. So there's 30 minutes of the day. So now I'm at 7 hours. There's a half hour lunch. I'm at 6.5 hours. 3 hours maximum learning on a good night's sleep. Holy cow. First of all, I've not met a teenager who can say like, oh, I had a great night's sleep last night. Because I was up till 4 in the morning on my Instagram account. And then... Mm-hmm. But then, what I'm hearing you say, and I just want to, again, in my own way, reiterate.
Yeah, yeah.
on a fully charged battery at 14 years old, I can absorb about 3 hours of learning, but not in a row.
It would diminish, yeah, over time. Yep, it's better not in a row.
He would be, nobody can sit for 180 minutes and then walk away and be like, wow, I got all
got it.
Right?
Yep.
But then I think the bigger part here, what I heard you say, especially in the digital environment, but even back in the regular classroom, half hour on, half hour off, half hour on, half hour off, half hour of information learning. And again, going back to those kind of four key areas.
Yeah.
Half hour application or neurological break.
Yeah.
Brain breaks.
Or practice, because that's a good thing. Is a brain break could be practice on a different so long as you already know a task. So like, think about it. If you go practice basketball now, that's not going to require that extra energy. It's a skill. It's knowledge you already have. So now you can go get better at it without having to waste energy. So this is what I love. The difference between learning. You've only got X amount of learning time each day, but you can then tap in and say, use that extra time to say, yeah, let's go do something. So let's connect this with what we learned yesterday and start locking that down even better.
Yeah. So let's use that analogy. So if I'm, you know, I think most people understand basketball. So if I sit for a half hour film session with the coach and the coach is lecturing, showing film, hey, like, this is what we need. This is the whatever. We got to do a box and one defense or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
My brain will go into overdrive learning that. But if I step onto the court now for 2 hours, my brain will use no more energy in the application of that, actually yeah. less energy than it had in the learning process.
It depends. So we tend to say if you practice things you've already kind of understood. So that first deep application might require that effort. So if you've just heard something for the very first time and now you have to go do it, like I'm just learning math and now I have to do it, that might require that extra juice. But once I figure out what the math patterns are, now I can start practicing. So it might take a couple of days where now I can practice addition without having to think too deeply about it. I can sit in that groove. So that immediate application might require, because I'm just thinking right now, if you taught me how to kick a soccer ball, I've never kicked a soccer ball, right? Well, I have, but I'm just theoretically. If you just taught me right now how to do it and said, now practice for a half hour, that half hour is going to be a lot of work up here. But once I sleep on it, come back, by about day three or four, I'll be like, cool, now I'm in a groove. I've seen this before. I've locked my memories down. Now I'm just in practice mode.
Sure, because now my brain is just retracing the map, right, that I've created.
Boom. So okay. If you've just built the map and then go into practice, so that's why you might want to break into, that's why I always say link it to something else. So if I teach you something new, now our breakout might be 80% what we learned last week. And I just want you bringing in about 20% of what we just learned this week. So I'm using my practice time to lock down skills and then trickle in these new skills that we're talking about without only focusing on the new skill. Does that kind of like, I feel like I'm, does that make sense or is it?
Makes total sense.
Okay, cool.
Because here's the deal with this. It's common sense, but now, it's research sense to apply to it. You know, when I was a middle school principal, we would hear all the time, take the kids who are struggling with math and make sure they have it in the first 2 hours of the day because they're the most alert. No, what I'm hearing you say is their fuel gauge for brain energy is full and that they can actually go ahead and do that. Okay, so Jared.
What's interesting, that makes a good point. I'd love to take a look at this, is if you have a class in later day, and I'm sure most teachers recognize this, I haven't been in a classroom in long enough that I don't really remember, but if you've got the last session of each day, do you just have kids that are just kind of, is it mostly behavioral management at that point? Because they're just tapped out.
If you have seventh hour, eighth hour, anything, you literally, right before class starts, pour kerosene over yourself and you set yourself on fire because you've got to get them. But again, now, you know, I'm just going to parlay this. We've been talking about the kids. Well, what about the instructors and the teachers and the administrators and the aides and that'll be new for the podcast. We're swearing now. Anybody, you know, in any part of the, in any industry, what good is going to happen at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? And, you know, there's been plenty of books that, you know, Daniel Pink wrote about this and some other things, but to hear that. So, I want to transition because there's something going on that is not going to resonate with what you just said. So across the United States, a lot of school districts are following this idea that they'll go 2 days of instruction in person and then 3 days digital. And a lot of the school systems, what they're doing on those 2 days of instruction is they're doing block instruction. What that means is 90-minute periods, 85-minute periods.
Yeah.
Of that class. Yeah. So if everybody could just see Jared's face, he did the slow blink like are you thinking? What do they need to consider in that? I mean, granted, you've given a couple of formulas here, but if so, I get one shot with this kid all week. Yeah. 90 minutes of instruction. I've got. What should we not do?
What you should not do is this is gonna suck because this is what we do at uni. But don't lecture them for 90 minutes. You could do that, but that's the surest way to make sure that they're only going to learn about 20% of what it is you wanted to teach them. So it might suck, but if all you've got is 90 minutes with them, this is me applying it through my own lens. So just take this as one dude's opinion, but I would open with a discussion.
First of all, I got to stop you. I love this. You're a recognized international neuroscientist who refers to himself as a dude.
As a dude, as just one dude.
And this is going to be trippy. Those are my favorite things.
This is what most people would have no clue. If you see what clothes I wear, most people are like, "You're not a neuroscientist, are you?" Yeah, I'm just really lazy. I had weird parents. My thought is, all right, I get 90 minutes with you live. My opening is just going to be talk, discussion. How are you doing? How are you feeling? Rebuild that connection. Because pretty much all learning is going to boil down to that relationship, which is going to be a lot easier to do live. Once I've got that, I'm going to do my review, my 5-10 minute review of everything we've been learning over the last week, whatever it's going to be. Review, 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 review. The more repetition is the key to any memory. So anytime the more you can get them bringing that stuff up, the better. And by the way, when it comes to a review, so we're talking about memories. You form memories for those things you think about. And memory is constructive. We like to think that input leads to deep memories. It really doesn't. Output leads to memories. Every time you access a memory, that's what makes it deeper. So the reason I remember my wedding isn't because it happened 10 times in my life. It's because I've thought about it. I've discussed it. I've brought it back up. Every time I access that memory, it gets deeper. The reason why I don't remember what a dollar bill looks like isn't because I haven't seen it 1,000 times. It's because I've never pulled that information out of my head before. So the memory is really weak. So during these review sessions, it's a lot of recall base. It's a lot of, can I get the kids to be yelling these answers out to me? Can I get them doing something to bring that information out? Use it somehow. Boom. Now I'm going to go into my 20, 25 minutes of new lesson where I'm going to go, here's a hook. Here's a cool story. Here's some content that's going to help us get there. Go to your activity. You guys solve this story for me. Come back and we're going to debrief and say, all right, now here's what's going to happen over the next week. I'm not going to see you for another week. So here's what we're going to be doing. Let's set out our plans. Here's our proximal goals. Each day I want us doing this. Here's our distal goal. By next week, I want us all be ready to do this. Off we go. So of that 90 minutes, it's really going to say, look almost exactly the same. You're going to have 25, 30 minutes worth of content of learning. We're going to have 35, 40 minutes worth of doing, new and old. And then the rest is discussion and relationship building.
Okay. So I'm going to reiterate.
Hit me.
But first of all, I have to tell you that I think one key thing that you said is that we are going to have to slow down and focus initially on some social emotional pieces and the relationship.
Yes.
How are you doing? Are you okay? What are you wondering? What do you need from me in order to be successful? Those types of kind of key pieces to start the hour. Because yeah. I can tell you right now, I think a lot of teachers are seeing that they got 90 minutes with that cohort and they're going to go bell to bell. Like, all right, everybody, we don't have a lot of time. We got to get started here. So sit down, open up page 58 and go. Where what I'm hearing you say is for my brain to propel my body to success, I need to, as a teacher, start out social, emotional, check-in, relationship. And again, it doesn't matter how much time, but just to make sure to do that. Second is review application, go back through, like you said, review, recall, you know, get them reapplying that stuff, build those dendritic muscles, right? Then go into new instruction and then close out with the application and review again.
Yep.
Okay.
And then plan and off you go. And it sounds scary, but really at the end of the day, nothing, nothing has to change. If you don't get them feeling safe around you, they're not going to learn. If you don't get them activating the information they need to make sense of the lesson they're about to have, they're not going to learn very easily. If you don't get them playing with the information, they're not going to learn. So, I mean, it sucks. I'd love to be able to do that every day, but if I can only do it one day, then I'm still going to do what works in that one day. I'm not going to throw everything up in the sky and change what we know is effective because I've only got one day with them. I'm just going to say, all right, let's do it. Let's lock this down for our one day.
Well, and going back to one of the things you said that, you know, where you've really got this 180 minutes, 3 hours maximum under all of the ideal conditions that you can learn in a day and use your brain power.
Yeah.
One of the things I'm hoping the teachers are hearing is, ooh, well, if they're in school for 7.5 hours, whose 3 hours are they going to pull? And now what I'm hearing you say is the 3 hours where they're going to be engaged is in front of the adult, digitally or in person, who first makes sure that I'm okay.
Yeah.
Then reviews to make sure that I understand. That then does the instruction. That then checks for understanding. That then reviews what I understand. That's my new formula right there, right?
I love it. I think that sounds perfect. And that's what I love is that's what we would do live. That's exactly what we're going to do digital. Nothing changes except the fact that we have a screen in front of us, but, and I can't feel your presence. But other than that, we're going to keep using the same techniques. If a technique works live, it's the same thing with, so we do a lot of research with learning disabilities, which now in the UK is called SEND, but I don't even know what that's acronym is. So apologies. But everyone's always saying, okay, well, I've got a kid with dyslexia. How do I teach them? I've got a kid with on the spectrum. How do I teach them? And the big joke is you teach them exactly the same as you teach everyone else. It's just they might need more time, more effort, or different stimuli. But the methods, the techniques don't change. If it works for a neurotypical kid, it's going to work for somebody else. We just need to drill it a little bit harder. If it works live, it's going to work digital. We might just need to play around the edges a bit, but the technique doesn't need to change. If it works, it works.
Well, and what you're indicating there is the old adage of kids can't be taught, kids can learn. So understand the basic premises of learning and then guide to that.
And nothing will change about learning. Learning has been the same for 100,000 years. As long as we've had a brain, it's been exactly the same. It doesn't change.
I can't remember who said it, but you know, I go home every single night and I teach my dog how to whistle, but God darn it, that dog can't whistle.
Still.
He can't learn to whistle, right? So you can teach all day long, but if the person in front of you can't learn, isn't engaged, isn't emotional, doesn't have motivation, it's not going to matter.
Boom. And you know what, an interesting thing, I just want to bring this up, kind of a slight tangent, but the stress issue could be big. It's oddly smaller than we thought it was going to be. So stress is really interesting in that in short-term bursts, it's fine. In fact, that's what helps us learn, is if I have a little bit of pressure, I'm doing better. It's once you hit chronic stress that learning just, essentially your learning mechanisms, your memory mechanisms shut down. It's a safety device. Your brain assumes that once you're in stress for 3, 4, 5 days straight, that you're actually in a helpless situation and you don't want to be forming deep memories if you're in a helpless situation, in which case it shuts your machinery down and it'll bring it back online once you're out of that situation. So we had a fear, and we still are talking about it, that through Corona, through COVID, a lot of kids would be hitting this chronic stress phase, in which case step number one, if you fear stress is an issue, is you have to abate the stress response. You don't shut the stress down, there's going to be no learning. How do you do it? The best way to do it is through relationships, is through safety and physical contact. Now, as a teacher, I can't hug my kids, but I can certainly make them feel safe and talk to them emotionally. And so that's why we always still say the best thing you can do is start the class with a relationship, like connect with them. How are you doing? See who's doing what, get them back into the zone, and then calm that stress response. The joke was, so we were closed 6 weeks, came back to school for about 3 weeks at the end of term, and now Melbourne's closed again. But when all the kids came back, we were expecting a lot of chronic stress and doing like a week of just nothing but calming everyone down and getting, the kids were fine. Man, I reckon maybe 2% of the kids were in chronic stress, nowhere near what we expected. The teachers were the ones who had done the chronic stress. As adults, we were the ones suffering through it, so worried about the kids going through it that they didn't even recognize that they were the ones in the chronic stress. And you can tell if you were. If you think about the first lockdown, which is going to be different in the US than here, if you actually try and pull out how much, as much as you remember about it, you'll know if you were in chronic stress if it's very little. Like I was thinking my first 6 weeks, I thought I was cruising, but really I've had conversations with people that I've had the exact same conversation afterwards and I didn't remember. I would say the same story and the dude's like, you already told me that. I cannot remember having had that conversation. Like that whole 6 weeks just became a blur to me. And that's a great sign that I was in chronic stress and my memory machinery was just shut down. So as much as we're looking at the stress for the kids, it's the teachers that probably need to pay attention to it. And if they're in that chronic stress mode, they need to unplug, find a connection, find a physical person to connect with and find a way to turn it down.
That was my last question for you. And it's a perfect segue is if you can only learn for 3 hours a day, what about the teaching end of it? Like where is that at? And for anyone hearing, I apologize, but for some reason, somebody in my house decided to print something while we were having this conversation. So
I heard the laundry machine went on back here too. So, hey, this is home life. This is what happens.
This is COVID, baby.
This is the teacher. I think we're so teaching and nursing are those two professions that are so externally focused that we tend to forget about ourselves and our own passions and drives. So always take care of yourself as a teacher and then recognize, and we've done it. Like if you've gone to a 2-day professional learning workshop, right, over the weekend, you've noticed by about hour 4 of day 1, it's kind of noise. And then you come back pumped, but then it gets, so we've got the same thing. If we're constantly learning a new tool and we're spending all day just simply learning how to make this machine work, we're going to tap out real fast. So you've got to temper your learning, temper your work, and do as much as you can on your own 30-minute brain breaks to get the heck out of Dodge, cool off. And it's so much easier said than done because I think as adults, we're in this, and I'm the same as you. I thought, oh, cool, COVID, I'm home, I get to relax. I've done more work being stuck at home than I would if I go into the office to do work. We just have this tendency to, if there's free time, I'm going to work. We've got to be very strict with our time and say, no, I'm going to force myself to do a 2-hour hike. But I've got so many emails. No, I've got to do these things. If we don't take care of our own stress now, it's going to bite us in the bum in a couple of weeks.
Well, and I think to your point with that, you know, one of the things we saw was, you know, going back to your example with the staff at the university is, you know, so many life cycle rituals were canceled. Yep. Graduation ceremonies, you know, different things like that. You guys are heading into that now in your spring. It was the old people who were freaking out the young people. Like, oh my gosh, you're not getting a high school graduation. Oh my gosh, you're not getting your first communion. Oh my gosh, you're not getting your bat mitzvah, whatever it was. And the kids were like, am I missing something really big? Because I go through these things because they're life cycle compliances when you're 19 or 17 or 16 years old.
Yeah.
And then what's awesome is the kids all pivoted. Their malleability in life is so much greater than old people. It's insane.
And it's how much do they look to us? I was thinking about this. One of my nieces bumped her head into the door a while back and you could tell nothing mattered to her. She's like, oh, okay. She looked over at mom and mom was like, oh, are you okay?
Oh yeah.
And in that moment, she's like, oh, was I supposed to be? Oh, okay. I guess that hurt. But she was just getting her cue from mom. It didn't matter. So it was really the parent that was suffering more than the kid and
right.
then sending that suffering over to the kid. And that's what I fear we did over here in Australia is we were so worried the kids would be screwed and they were doing fine that we're now making them feel nervous. Cause it's like, oh, but what are you going to do for standardized tests? Like they care about standardized tests. They're happy that they don't have to take them. We're the ones who care. So well, God forbid we should have to think differently about our systems, but no, they're Teflon. They bounce back from everything.
Yeah, that's what's powerful about today is the coaching to the emotional resilience that we need as educators, but also how to create the environment for learning digitally and in the classroom to take into consideration the brain. With everything going on, you know, everybody's like, I got to get to the content. I got to get to the standards. I got to get all of this. I got to get all this. What became very evident today was slow down, stay in first gear. Focus on the child's safety because then their brain will engage. Minimize the amount of information you're giving them and maximize the amount of application.
I'd rather do 45 minutes of good learning rather than 90 minutes of nonsense learning. You're going to take away more. There's going to be depth. You're moving slower, but you're moving further going that way. So, you know what, an interesting, can I make one last point? I know we're wrapping up here. I just don't want to, there's one last thing that we have to consider is this context issue. So if you're going the blended mode, when we learn, we tie that learning to the place where we learned it. And then once we move to a different context, it can often be hard to reaccess those memories or that learning, not because we didn't learn it, but because we've tied it to a different spot and now we have to reactivate it somewhere else. So we might see during the blended, you might notice, just pay attention to what you're teaching live versus what you're teaching online. So what the kids are getting in your room versus what they're getting at home, because there might be issues of shifting between the two, where you taught something just fine live and everyone showed they got it. And then once you go digital, all of a sudden they can't do it. And you're going, well, didn't we just do this in class the other day? And then they finally get the online stuff and they come back to the classroom and they can't. And you're like, we just did this online yesterday. We might need to spend some time, and this could be the review stuff, just reactivating those memories that they learned in the different contexts across contexts, just to make sure they can use them in both spots. So it's not that they didn't, I always say, don't worry. It's not that they didn't learn it. The information is in there. It's that they just don't recognize that what happened on my computer in my bedroom is now sensical over here in the classroom. It's the same thing as bumping into a colleague at the supermarket. You know them, but you can't really place it. And it's not that you don't know them, it's that it's just the wrong context. Well, so you might just need to spend some time recontextualizing ideas back and forth.
You just described 12 years of math for me. Because day I left that classroom thinking I understood what was going on, got home, opened up the book, had to do the evens or whatever, and then was like, what? You know, so I've always used that because that's, I can go into a social studies or history environment and I get it all. Boom. And when I walk out, you know, I'm like, how can you guys not understand that? But
some people struggle with that context shift.
Yeah.
So that'll be just a cool thing. That was going back to that idea of starting with a little review after the relationship. That could be it. Is the review is just a recontextualization exercise. We learned this at home. Now let's bring it into the classroom.
And the access for that one-on-one ability for them to get, you know, regrounded or redirected or relearning.
Yeah. Bingo.
So Jared, this has been amazing. I've learned a boat load, but my last question for you is, so if people want to learn more from you beyond this, how can we access your knowledge base and grow as educators and people?
Yeah. So if you go on, we have a website called lmeglobal.net. And if you go on there, we have a course called The Learning Blueprint for teachers. So it's going to eventually be, I think, 4 modules, but we're done with module 1 and it's totally free to access. So if you go on there, it's got about 5 lessons that go through essentially foundations of thinking and a bunch of learning principles as well. So just a kind of a great little short course if you're interested in taking that. We've also got that book, Stop Talking, Start Influencing, which is available. You can get that on Amazon. That's online. That's in bookstores. That's everywhere. And so the course is free. The book, not free. If I could, I'd send you all a copy, but publishers, I can't do it. Sorry. Yeah, so, right. But it's just good outlets to kind of get these ideas out there and get people thinking about the science of learning. And then how do we adapt that for our teaching? So I'm not a big fan on telling teachers how to teach. I always say, you guys know how to do that better than anyone else in the world. So science of learning is not meant to replace you or tell you what to do. It's simply a new lens through which to understand and interpret the behaviors you're doing. So maybe new ideas kind of spring from that. So that's kind of my bag now. So anyone interested, it's all yours.
And then the last thing, Jared, before we log off the podcast is, you know, you and I talked about this, so hopefully I can preview this. I will be putting in the podcast. So when you're on iTunes or whatever your platform is, you can go into the description. I'll have his the email, or I'll have the website available for you and the name of his book with the Amazon link right away for you. But then the next thing is, I'm excited. We talked about this before the podcast of potentially collaborating and creating kind of a webinar series between, you know, you and I, where we have this conversation, we open it up for teachers, and then we show them, you know, multiple ways of delivering instruction and using the you know, your 12 principles, but then also being able to interact and grow forward. You know, 1 hour with you, I think you guys could pick up. I think Jared and I could spend about 20 hours running in circles together just to burn off energy and learning from each other. So I love this interaction, man. And I appreciate this. And I hope you stay safe over there in Australia and in Melbourne. And we appreciate the opportunity to learn from you today. So thanks for joining me on the Smart Thinking Podcast.
No, thank you so much. And everyone over there, stay safe too.
So let's do some smart thinking. What is the impact of sleep in the brain's ability to acquire knowledge? What are the 4 or 5 key instructional strategies that need to be employed every single lesson to ensure that kids and adults capture the main message? And finally, describe the importance of relationships in building instructional brain strategies that are tactically important and will stick. That's it. That's the Smart Thinking Podcast. Hey, as always, thank you for listening. I know this was a long podcast, so I don't have a big thing here to end for us. So thank you very much. And thanks to the Well Pennies for their great music. Please feel free to share this on your social media platform. And please shoot this around to as many teacher friends that you have to make sure that they recognize all of the different ways that we can very quickly and easily, yes, I said easily, if we're paying attention to the brain, increase a child's, an adult's ability to learn. All right, now let's end this on a high note. After talking to Jared Horvath here, knowing that he's in Australia, knowing that some of the Australian rock that's come out over the course of my lifetime is some of the best, feeling inspired that we can actually get through all of the different things we have to do through COVID, all the different ways we have to be different for kids, and all the ways we can now be successful with his help, I thought we could end this podcast with a little bit of fun, turn up some AC/DC, drive down the road, run a little faster, reflect a little louder. But either way, let's enjoy the moment. Let's do our best for kids, and let's enjoy this great song.